Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Welcome to a rather unusual issue of The Spectator podcast. Throughout lockdown, we're asking our writers to read some of what they've written for the magazine. We had thought we'd do this for 2 or 3 weeks and then we'd all be back to work. It seems as if lockdown is going to be with us for a while in one shape or another. First of all, we have Fredrik Eriksson, who's reading his cover story about what lockdown is looking like and the route out of lockdown is looking like in Europe. We have James Forsyth, who's talking about how the government is going to be rewiring itself after this is finished. And Leith Arbuthnot, who has a book being published right now about the book launch party, which isn't. First of all, Fredrik Eriksson.
Last week, Europe started its liberation from lockdown, and it all feels like a study in national political identity. Belgium took its first step towards deconfinement, but no one seems exactly sure what that means. France is opting for complexity rather than simplicity. Italy's national plan for easing its lockdown is more convoluted still, but few regions bother to follow it anyway. Spain goes a national joke, went more slowly and started with a reopening of the siesta. And in Germany, everyone is praising the country's scientific approach to the pandemic, but as soon as they were allowed to roam freely again, many Germans headed for the beer gardens. Governments say their approach is guided by the science. In reality, science doesn't offer any clear way out of this mess. There is no vaccine around the corner, no answers even to basic questions: how the virus spreads, how many have been infected, while children seem immune. Politics, not science, decides the path out of lockdown. Each country is reopening one step at a time and its own way, searching for what works in practice, given the lack of certainty. Europe, with all its variety, has become a laboratory experiment in how to end lockdowns. Here in Sweden, the experiment has involved not locking down at all, but instead asking people to socially distance. Gatherings of fewer than 50 are allowed, as are sports events for young people. Church services and dinner parties continue. The distancing has left many of our streets as empty as Britain's, though, and our economy has suffered. We too have a scandal of too many deaths in care homes. Our guess, and as with everywhere else, it's not much more than a guess, is that we're seeing the tail end of it. Our deaths are about average for Europe, albeit higher than the rest of Scandinavia. The virus has spread pretty widely, and we hope it brings immunity in its wake. A study last week suggested herd immunity in Stockholm could be achieved next month, and with an infection rate of 40%. But Sweden's experiment has not, it seems, tempted other countries to copy it. Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock are inspired by the testing-intensive German model, and understandably so. Germany has tested about 3 million people for the virus, and its tech approach explains how the country has managed to keep its death toll so low. Mass testing is also crucial for Germany's reopening plan. Bars, restaurants and small shops can now take customers again, provided that staff wear face masks and that people respect social distancing rules. The Bundesliga will restart, but Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund and other clubs won't be playing in crowded stadiums. Later this month, pupils will start going back to schools. Even Germany's strategy has at times been held up by Britain as an example of what not to do. The UK is judging things by the rate at which the virus spreads, the so-called R number. The aim is to maintain it at below 1, so the number of new infection falls. Although the R is not published daily in Britain, it is in Germany. And a week after Angela Merkel declared the reopening of the country, it has risen from 0.65 to above 1. This was taken by Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, as proof of what happens to countries that reopen too hastily. But by whose standards? In Germany, there is clear support for phased reopening. Unlike in Britain, German authorities aren't too alarmed by rises in the R number, which in any case is subject to a lot of assumptions, guesswork, and regional variation. Instead, Germans are judging their approach to lockdown by a simpler test, the number of infections. If the number of weekly cases is higher than 50 per 100,000 population in any given area, then the regulations will tighten, but only in that area. This brings us to an important aspect in the question of ending lockdown: regional differences. We're all used to seeing virus graphs comparing Britain's progress with, say, Spain or France. But this disguises a crucial point. There are huge variations within countries. In the past week, Bavaria has averaged 195 new cases a day. Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania, however, has recorded only 4 per day. The north of Italy was horribly affected, the south hardly at all. A quarter of all Stockholmers have now had the virus, according to official estimates. Its COVID rate has been 6 times that of Malmö. One regional council leader confessed that he had come to the capital to try to catch the virus, to gain immunity. In the US, Donald Trump has reduced to the status of an onlooker, cheering on the states that are easing lockdown. There is variety even within those states. In Florida, restaurants are open, except in Miami and Palm Beach. And in South Dakota, businesses can reopen in counties that are not hotspots for the virus. Kristi Noem, its governor, says this approach would put the power of decision-making into the hands of the people, where it belongs. Even Emmanuel Macron has given up on his earlier idea of France taking a national approach to lockdown. While the reopening of schools is part of a national plan, many parts of France have been given permission to come out of lockdown faster than others. They make up what is called the green zone, the 80 or so département where the virus isn't circulating much. Paris and the northeast, however, are a red zone. While Parisians no longer need to fill in a document to leave their houses, they are still restricted. They aren't able to dine at the local bistros, and nor are the city's parks and gardens open during this phase. France wouldn't be France if the pandemic didn't inspire new grand attempts to engineer the economy in typical top-down fashion. The French Minister of Labour has issued a 20-page plan for new safety measures at businesses big and small, adding to the 48 COVID workplace guidelines that were introduced in late April. Thanks to the government, every business owner now knows how to clean the premises and improve workflow management. Then there is the technological response to the virus. Is there an app for that? And if not, can we make one? France, like Britain, has declined offers from Google and Apple to build decentralized tracing apps and instead created its own national app, Stop COVID. The government has promised that it will be ready next month, even though it hasn't been fully tested yet. The main flaw is rather obvious. If the virus can spread through people who never develop symptoms, how will they be detected by any app? The French Assembly doesn't look entirely comfortable about approving the app, just as in Belgium, where the government recently cancelled plans for digital tracing. There are now strong concerns in France that the app could prefigure a power grab. Deputies from both the ruling party, Macron's La République En Marche, and the opposition assumes that people won't like having Big Brother in their phone now that they have been freed from their mandatory confinement. Overall, though, local and decentralized approaches do seem to work better than big national efforts. There are cultural differences to consider, as well as the uneven spread of the virus. Bavaria isn't the same as Berlin, and Bruges isn't the same as Brussels. Local authorities can move faster than national governments. When power is dispersed rather than concentrated, there is a better chance that successful policies will be found and adopted in other places, and that failures will be spotted. The reason Germany does so well with testing is, in part, that it doesn't have a centralized health service. It has 16 strong state governments and, below that, 401 districts, together with a strong private medical sector. Since Berlin isn't running the country's healthcare system, hospitals didn't have to wait for Merkel or a Reichstag committee to scale up testing. Local authorities could do that on their own and were able to experiment a lot in setting up their facilities for mass testing. And German states that were less quick off the block could catch up by copying what other states were doing. the idea of a nationally imposed lockdown grates with many of Europe's regions. A court in the German state of Saarland, for instance, ruled in late April that several of its restrictions were unconstitutional. Last month, there were small demonstrations in several German cities where people were protesting against restrictions on civil liberties. It became increasingly difficult to dismiss such protesters as right-wing trolls, especially as petitions were also filed at other state courts. Similar rebellions are underway in Italy. This week, for instance, the government in South Tyrol has allowed bars, restaurants and hairdressers to open up again, despite several warnings from Rome that regions shouldn't allow restaurants to have seated guests before June. In Veneto, people can now sit down outdoors for a drink and at a bar, and again, against Rome's instructions, they can travel freely within the region to take care of second homes. Lombardy and several other regions have warned the national government that if restrictions on shops, salons and beaches aren't lifted next week, they will abolish them anyway. Everywhere there is political posturing. Many leaders find their opinion poll ratings boosted by the crises. Some find it difficult to wean themselves off strongman politics. Hungary's Viktor Orban has used the pandemic as an opportunity to grab more power, and he isn't planning to hand it back. Meanwhile, Denmark's centre-left Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, has increased her party's ratings by 8% since early March, and she would like to maintain her Iron Lady image. Danes, she seems to think, have enjoyed the firm smack of the government and want more of it. Local political leaders, too, are enjoying the spotlight. Markus Söder, the state premier of Bavaria, has been labelled Deutschland's Corona hardliner, and he is vying for stronger national influence. Set against him is Armin Laschet, the state leader of North Rhine-Westphalia, who is now the frontrunner to take over the national party and succeed Merkel. He has been airing his frustration with national lockdown policies for more than a month. Laschet took a more liberal line than Merkel and couldn't wait to rid the country of what he considered silly restrictions. In the end, Laschet and other state premiers made it politically impossible for Merkel not to start reopening the country. Where does all this leave Britain? Staying in lockdown may be a crushingly expensive luxury, but at least it allows the opportunity to learn from other countries about what works and what doesn't. If the UK wants to recreate Germany's machinery of testing, it may need to consider how to decentralise things and allow more regional experiments. But overall, the lesson is that any leader seeking to protect their economy and society will, at some point, have to take the plunge. There are no certainties, not enough signs, no chance of avoiding risk. But when the time comes to break from the lockdown, like every country, Britain will be flying in the dark.
That was Frederick Erickson, now James Forsyth.
COVID-19 has been perhaps the biggest test of governments worldwide since the 1940s, declares the government's command paper on the virus. The fact that the following paragraph proposes a rapid re-engineering of government structures and institutions is telling. It is an implicit admission that the British government machine is, in several important areas, failing this test. The argument about whether the UK has the worst death toll in Europe risks descending into statistical absurdity. Until excess mortality figures are known, it won't be possible to come to a verdict. But it's hard to argue that the UK has done much better than France, Spain and Italy. We have clearly done worse than Germany and are miles behind South Korea, Taiwan and Japan. To put it another way, there'll be no international teams coming to this country to learn how to prepare for a pandemic. This is all the more shocking given that for some time a pandemic has been at the top of the national risk register. The UK government regarded itself as being one of the best prepared in the world, but it had been preparing for an influenza pandemic. Considering that COVID-19 is the third coronavirus outbreak this century after SARS and MERS, this was an unacceptable failure of imagination. Britain has long prided itself on its Rolls-Royce government machine. This crisis, though, has exposed its limitations. One Whitehall veteran says that the 10 days leading up to the 23rd of March were the nearest the wiring of a state has come to a collapse. It wasn't just blowing a fuse, the motherboard was beginning to melt down. The lockdown has cast the state centre stage. It is paying the bulk of the wages of 7.5 million private sector workers and offering cash support, loan guarantees and cheap credit to businesses. But as one Secretary of State admits, the government couldn't have got through this crisis without the private sector. For instance, there haven't been the food shortages that many feared there would be when supply chains began to be disrupted. When the government was failing on testing, private companies stepped in to help it hit its 100,000-a-day target. This private sector involvement is going to continue to be crucial. I understand that key figures in government believe this country will need the capacity to carry out 500,000 tests a day if the lockdown is to be properly lifted, though others think 200,000 will be enough for a comprehensive track and trace strategy. A hubristic belief in the ability of a state to do it all lay behind the most disastrous decision of this whole episode, the ending of testing and tracing early in the outbreak. Ministers were told that there wasn't the capacity to carry out enough tests as the virus started spreading, but there could have been. The problem was that businesses, universities and research institutes were not being asked for help by Public Health England. A more collaborative approach, as seen in Germany, would have allowed testing to be increased at sufficient speed. Part of the difficulty was that Public Health England, created in 2013, is an arm's length body. This means that while the Secretary of State for Health can remove its chair, he can't tell it what to do on a day-to-day basis. One result of the past few months will be these arm's length bodies will lose their autonomy. In future, ministers will be able to issue them with instructions. Another body that is the subject of much ire is the Cabinet Office. One of its jobs is to coordinate between various players: Scientific Advisory Committee, SAGE, the Department of Health and Social Care, Public Health England and the rest of government. According to Whitehall sources, it has struggled. At first blush, this seems strange, and is run by Michael Gove, regarded as the Tories' most effective departmental minister. Indeed, Gove's ability to run a department is one of the reasons Boris Johnson kept him in the Cabinet, despite their spectacular rupture in 2016. But only half of the Cabinet Office answers to Gove. The other half is the civil service fiefdom. This must change if government is to function better. Theresa May's time in Number 10 made this problem worse. There used to be three secretariats, one covering economic and domestic policy, another national security, and a third EU and global issues. She merged them into one. This has led to a lack of debate within Whitehall. One hawking government says that this issue has been compounded by Cabinet Secretary Sir Mark Sedwill staying on as national security advisor. They complained that in a well-functioning system, the National Security Advisor would have challenged the Cabinet Secretary on the Huawei decision. But that can't happen when the National Security Advisor and the Cabinet Secretary are the same person. A breakup of Sir Mark's empire looks inevitable. Cabinet government has also been a victim of the lockdown. Even one ally of the Prime Minister admits everything is getting more fractious. The mood of the outer Cabinet, everyone in Cabinet apart from Gove, Matt Hancock, Rishi Sunak and Dominic Raab, is turning rancorous. They are irritated to see decisions taken before the Cabinet has met. They feel that their advice is being ignored. Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, has told allies that he offered the military's help to try and lessen the tragedy seen in care homes. On one occasion last month, Wallace wanted to join the morning coronavirus call, which is more important than Cabinet meetings these days. One member of the Cabinet, who is always on the call, objected and said that he wasn't comfortable with the chatty Wallace dialing in, with the result that the Defence Secretary was not involved. He has though been on calls which have discussed the armed forces' role in the COVID response. The debate in this country is all too often about whether we want big or small government, when what we really need is effective government. Britain has long flattered itself that it leads the world in administration, but COVID-19 has highlighted how far from being true that now is. The British state needs rewiring for the 21st century, if the system is not to melt down completely in the next crisis.
James Forsyth. And finally, Leith Arbuthnot.
To my surprise, what I miss most about life before the lockdown are parties. As others pine for restaurants and theatres, I am longing for sticky floors and 4 a.m. Ubers. Give me plastic cups and music so loud you feel it in your kidneys. Sylvia Plath wrote disparagingly of the shrill tinsel gaiety of parties with no purpose. It's precisely that shrillness and pointlessness that I'm yearning for, drunk young bodies cramming together for no reason other than to be close to one another. At the weekend, my longing finally spilled over and I decided to make do online. I put on a nice top and loaded my lashes with mascara. I'm spending the pandemic at my parents' house in the suburbs, and while they watched Foyle's War in the sitting room, I stood next door with my laptop and third glass of champagne cruising the internet for raves. I dropped by a party on Zoom that had been put on to raise money for the NHS. There was a DJ playing 90s hits and about 30 strangers in little squares on my screen dancing away in their living rooms. I turned out the lights and began to cut some shapes too, imagining I was in a club and someone had spilled vodka orange down my top. After a while, I felt a euphoric sense of goodwill to all these strangers dancing together alone. One of the aspects of city life that I'd been missing since the virus spread is the routine presence of strangers. Now I rarely see anyone I don't know well. But these virtual dance events thrust you into countless bedrooms and kitchens filled with people you will never see again. On Zoom, you can get a good look at your fellow attendees and I paused my dancing to snoop. One couple were watching the party unfold impassively as if it were the evening news. A woman in a sports bra was tossing her hair around. Another window showed a Labrador being stroked by someone off camera. It was as good a Saturday night as I've had since the pandemic hit. Put it down to COVID-induced anxiety or simple clumsiness, but I seem to be breaking things at the moment. The latest casualty was a mixing bowl which I smashed on the kitchen floor. Glass scattered everywhere, and I spent a hunched 10 minutes with a dustpan and brush, trying to sort it all out. My mother advised that I vacuum, but I couldn't be bothered. She pursed her lips. Wind forward a few hours, and I entered the kitchen to chaos. My sister was groaning, her foot gushing blood. My mother was leaning over her, expertly tweezering out a nugget of glass from her skin. I felt horribly contrite and ran to get the vacuum cleaner. But when I came back, both sister and mother were crying with laughter, having staged the whole thing. Apparently Tabasco mixed with ketchup makes for realistic fake blood. I vacuumed. It's strange to be publishing a book during a plague. In my novel, out this week in no physical bookshops near you, my widowed character Ada gives a reading from her new poetry collection. She's nervous, but it goes well. Thanks to the virus, I'm at least to be spared the indignity of fewer people turning up to a reading of mine than my fictional characters. The book is about loneliness and the longing for community, two subjects that suddenly seem fairly central. While publishers are wringing their hands about the state of the industry, books feel more important than ever. I'm currently inching through Hilary Mantel, not the new one, but her novel about the French Revolution, A Place of Greater Safety. In 1770, she writes, life expectancy in France was 29 years. Hangings were routine, so were bread riots. However bad we think we have it, life is a good deal better now than it was. Much as I'm glad to have more time to read, I resent the pandemic for having constricted conversation. The only telly people seem to be watching is normal people. The only topic they are willing to discuss in depth is the pandemic and its impact on them. Monoculture is back. I miss having conversations in which plot and surprise featured. Even before the crisis, my friends and I communicated largely by sending one another meandering voice messages recorded on WhatsApp. I'm still receiving and sending them throughout the day. But no one has much to report other than the vagaries of their emotional life and how much they are lusting after the jumpers in normal people. Norbert, Ernie, Boo. These are just some of the names of our new chicks, christened by my little sister. People keep asking me where they come from, as though hopeful I know of some underground hen railroad where they can get their hands on illicit chicks too. We got them from their mothers, boringly. When the birds first hatched, they didn't look like much. No fluff to speak of and creepily large feet. But they're becoming formidably cute. It's no use telling chicks to social distance, either. The five of them crowd together gaily, pecking one another and chattering about the day's events. Life goes on. But it might not, for much longer. A red kite has noticed them and is planing high above the yard where the chickens live. I'm inspired by that scene in Fantastic Mr. Fox, and may sit by the coop in a raincoat with a rifle on my lap till the danger passes.
That was Leif Arbuthnot, and this is the end of this particular episode of Spectator Audio Reads. We're still playing around with this format. We're very grateful for any feedback you might want to send in. You can email us at podcasts@spectator.co.uk. We always read that inbox, and it's always great to hear from our readers. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our producer, Cindy Xiaodanyu.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger